Welcome to Studio Sacramento. Today's topic is domestic violence in the age of coronavirus. My guests today are Jenny Davidson from Stand Up Placer and Beth Hassett from We. Beth, what exactly is the impact on domestic violence victims during this pandemic?
People are already very isolated when they're a victim of domestic violence, and this is just further isolating people who already aren't necessarily maintaining connections with outside people because they've got an abusive partner who's restricting that. So we're very worried about what's going on in some of these homes behind closed doors with really nobody checking in with some of these folks.
And Jenny, what exactly is the definition of abuse?
Abuse is really, what we're seeing with domestic violence is one person's decision to use power and control over another person. It can come in a lot of different ways. There could be, honestly, like one of the tools used frequently we see is isolation, right? So this is just being escalated right now a lot more than usual. And then there's, of course, emotional abuse, psychological abuse. There's physical abuse. That's what a lot of us think of. There's sexual abuse. There's a lot of different forms of abuse that we see in these relationships. But because isolation is one of the tools that abusers use, we just sort of handed them a loaded weapon as people are forced to isolate with their abuser.
And Jenny, give us the statistics for our region. What are we looking at in terms of how big the problem is?
Well, generally we, and statistics, you know, like they can change from time to time, but like the age-old numbers we look at is 1 in 4 women, 1 in 7 men are victims of severe domestic violence. And we know that when you're looking at emotional abuse and psychological abuse, those numbers are much, much higher. And so if you think about, if you have 20 pretty good friends, if a quarter of them are victims of domestic violence, that's a lot. And in your neighborhood, you know, if you have 4 houses on your street, that's happening in you know, potentially happening in one of those homes. So it's way more common than people think.
I think most people would be shocked to think about that happening that frequently.
Yeah, and if you don't know of anyone it's happened to, they just haven't told you. So we know that it's happening. If it's 1 in 4 or 1 in 7 for severe violence, right? And then plus potentially 1 in 2 if you're looking at just emotional and psychological abuse, which are huge, terrible statistics as well. It's really, really prevalent. And our survivors don't necessarily have a way to reach out to people a lot of times. And that's so much more severe right now as people are isolated. They've lost their work connections. They have lost a lot of the times when they may have normally been able to speak up to somebody who might be able to help them.
Right. Beth, who is it typically that your agency serves? Give us a sense of the range.
You know, it depends on which services we're talking about. If we're looking at our residential program, so emergency and transitional housing, definitely skews towards somebody with a lower income. The average income of somebody in our shelter program is $7,600. The average client of ours is 38 and has 2 children, and definitely skews more towards people of color. In our region, African-American clients are overrepresented in our residential program, and certainly those are the clients that have the fewest resources. If you start talking about counseling and legal services, you know, it really is all socioeconomic levels and people who are coming to us because we have an expertise in a particular area, and they may have resources but just not have access to them, since financial abuse is a very common type of abuse that, as Jenny said, we think of physical abuse, we might think of emotional abuse, but there are all other tools that an abuser might use.
Tell us more about financial abuse. That's one I've not heard of before.
You know, I think it's important that we talk more about it, because it can look like a lot of things. What we see is somebody destroying somebody else's credit, somebody having complete control over the money, or hiding funds from the victim. It's also, you know, full-on identity theft, debt coercion, making somebody sign on for, you know, loans that they don't even realize what they're signing. And it really puts people in a precarious situation where they can't get their own apartment. They can't get a job. You know, they're mired in this debt that they've built up. So it's a very common tool, again, across all socioeconomic levels.
And Jenny, how has this pandemic, as just a new occurrence, affected your typical clients?
Well, what we know about the dynamics of domestic violence is that abusers will frequently isolate victims so that that victim can't ask for help or tell people what's going on. But they usually find some ways. They go to the grocery store and they tell somebody. They go to work and they tell somebody. They make a phone call on their lunch break, or their partner goes to work and they have that period of time when they can reach out and talk to someone. But right now, with the shelter in place, people being isolated, they've lost most of those outside connections. They've lost that ability to just stop at the police station on, you know, while they're out of the house to get groceries. You know, they tell their abuser, hey, I'm going to go to the pharmacy and get this diaper rash medication, but maybe they, you know, actually leave the house and go somewhere else. But right now, when they're being told to stay home all the time, and abusers know, you know, like, you're not just out running errands, you're not out buying fabric, then they don't have that access. Their abuser is right there watching them all the time. They can't just pick up their phone and call and ask for help. And not only that, but like, the stressors are up. So everybody's on edge. The healthiest people right now are on edge, right? All of us are thinking about, what is this doing to my 401k? Or what is this doing to my loved one who's in that vulnerable category? So we're all already a little bit more on edge. And so it's increasing the amount of stress and strain in those households as well.
Can I also add that, you know, kids are at home. Kids can often be a huge additional stressor. And so now we've got, you know, partners trying to do homeschooling with the kids. You've got kids watching everything that's going on. Very often, you know, the violence is happening when the kids aren't in the house. Well, now the kids are there all the time. So I think one thing we're really worried about as well is, what's the impact on these children who are witnessing this domestic violence, either as secondary victims or as a primary victim? And I know Jenny's had to do the same thing in Placer County. We've really had to completely adapt our services to...
I am curious about that, Beth, because I want to know, if someone is a victim and they're in danger, where do they go?
Well, we still have, as of today, 58 people in our residential program. We haven't been actively admitting new people, although we had one case where... he was strangling her every day to the point of unconsciousness. We brought her into shelter, but so we're trying to take care of these people in person, but then we've moved to a lot of virtual telephonic support. And I frankly have been very surprised at how many people are taking us up on phone counseling, phone emotional support, phone legal services. We added online chat as a feature to our website, so that people for whom it's not safe to make a phone call can go into another room and communicate with us through online chat. So we're having to look at completely different ways to support people more virtually, and they still are needing support. So that's been the really shocking thing to us.
Do you find that these new modes that you're forced to adapt to, are they of the same impact for the victims as your traditional services? Or is this merely a stopgap?
You know, other than the online chat, which was something we were getting ready to roll out later this year anyway, and we really put the rush on it, these are all stopgaps. It is not best practice. You know, we're people serving people, and now we're having to be people serving people over the phone. So it just, you know, it certainly isn't the same. And what we're really seeing is the calls we are getting and the interactions we're having with clients are much more violent and dangerous and scary than our telephone calls. We're getting people who are really isolated, really in dangerous relationships with nowhere to go. and the violence is escalating within the home in a way that it wouldn't if people could go take a time out, go somewhere else. So the intensity of the phone calls that we're getting, my advocates are telling me, are just, overwhelmingly difficult. They did a 1 hour online chat with a pregnant woman who was very fearful that he was going to end her pregnancy, that sort of thing. I mean, that's not an everyday usual conversation that we have. And it's scary, and it's taking a toll on the staff as well.
Jenny, are you experiencing the same things?
So as far as the, whether the service delivery is ideal, it's not, but we're also seeing potentially some areas where we will be able to, we're hoping, hold on to some of these stopgap things, because we do have people in Placer County. It's a very large county, and we have people who live really far away from our offices and haven't been able to maybe make a therapy appointment in the past. But now that we're doing therapy through online portals and things, being able to access some of those people who previously have just been on our wait list for maybe a long time, and now they're actually able to get the services. So some of those things, I think, have been great for us when we look at, can we hold on to this one? But it's definitely, like Beth was saying, not ideal for the people who would have access to come in person and go over forms together, especially when you're looking at like legal interventions. And I know Beth and I talked yesterday about this, that, you have somebody who, they have been working on getting child custody arrangements for months, and they were just at this precipice. They had a court date scheduled 2 weeks from now. They were finally going to get custody, and they know this child is being exposed to things or being abused in their partner's home. And it was just about to happen for them. And then now the courts are closed, other than like emergency restraining orders and stuff. So people are having to put things on hold for a longer period of time that they had hoped would be dealt with by now, right?
Like that sounds like that could be traumatic in itself.
It's absolutely traumatic. Absolutely. Especially now they know not only are the kids staying with the abusive partner, but the kids aren't going to school either. And they're around that abuse more than ever. And so that, I think, has been one of the really traumatizing things for victims is, and that's completely out of our control. The courts are closed. There's nothing that we could do to make that better for our survivors.
Beth, you mentioned something that I hadn't even considered, which is the toll that this is taking on your staff. Tell us a little bit about how your staff is reacting, not only to providing services, but having to do that while thinking about their own situations.
It's interesting. This work takes a toll anyway, but usually we have the support of each other, some camaraderie of being in the office together, and a little more spaciousness between some really horrific stories and trauma that we're absorbing, and just not one thing right after the other. So we've put in a lot of things. We've hired a therapist who's doing video therapy that Weave is paying for any of our staff that need it. We've got some counselor-led support groups. We're encouraging people to use our employee assistance program. Also trying to do some fun virtual things through Teams and other technology. I just was on an all-staff meeting. We had 67 of us at an all-staff meeting, just, sharing what we're seeing and, sharing some successes, doing some fun things like doing some Survey Monkey surveys about, what are you cooking while you're isolated? What TV shows are you watching? But we also know we've got a lot of, young staff who live alone, maybe in a tiny apartment, maybe in neighborhoods where they don't feel confident and comfortable going outside and walking around. So it's a very, very hard time for the workforce as well as the clients we're serving.
I'm curious as to how you and Jenny are putting your arms around the extent of whether the problem is growing and how it may be metastasizing under the conditions we're living under right now. Because we hear anecdotes, but what is the data? Is there any data?
I metastasizing is a good way to put it. What I'm really worried about is, I lived through the recession doing this job. And what we saw during the actual downturn was people were staying put. You know, there wasn't anywhere to go. They were worried about jobs. So we really felt the rush of that domestic violence coming after things had stabilized a little bit. I know in talking with
after they had stabilized.
You know, once the economy, and in this case, you know, once we're through this virus, I know in talking with my counterparts in Napa and in Sonoma, like during the fires, domestic violence calls did not go up. But once, again, everybody had gotten a little more stabilized as a community, they started hearing the really horrible stories and people started coming in for help. So we're just bracing ourselves for once we get hopefully on the other side of this curve, I think we're going to see more people. And as Jenny said, with the legal system, I'm very worried about that. We have so many clients who were just waiting for their final orders or for their divorce to be final. I don't even know how our court is going to go about scheduling all of these hearings that are now on hold. I mean, we're going to be months out before some of these people get any resolution to their cases.
Jenny, I'm curious. Beth talked about what happened after the financial crisis and what's happened after other disasters.
Are there other lessons that you all have learned from observing other catastrophes that help inform how you're planning not only for tomorrow, but for the future in terms of what people are going to need and how they're going to need it?
I think that we can kind of learn from the countries that are a couple weeks ahead of us, and then just from other big disasters that we've seen, like Beth was saying, with the recession and with the fires, and just making sure that we are realistically anticipating what we're going to see on the other side of it, and that we are ready to stand in the gap when that comes up, and that we are prepared for what our staff are going to go through, because there's also like that piece where they've all been at home now for a few weeks, and then they're going to be coming back into the office and happy to see each other, but they're going to have this floodgate open of how much work there is to do with how many new clients we're going to be seeing, or so how we can be most supportive of them during that time as well. There are a lot of us are just sort of guessing and hoping that we're guessing correctly about what people are going to need on the other end of this, and you know, educated guesses, because we can look at how it's happened in other situations, but just doing our best to anticipate it during this situation and meeting their needs in that moment.
Jenny, I'm curious, because of the size of Placer County, how are people reaching you since they can't physically get in the door?
Yeah, so they are calling us on the phone. We have video chat available for people who are more comfortable. Some people would prefer, they want to see your face, they want to know who I'm talking to. Other people don't want you to see their face. And so we have some where we're on the video, but they're not, but they can see us. And so we're just trying to be creative with how we make that happen for them. Sometimes they're talking with somebody they've met with in person quite a few times anyway, so they are reassured by seeing them on those chat lines. But we've always had, we've been around for over 40 years, and we have always had the crisis line, 1-800-575-5352. And Beth can give hers as well, but so that people can get a hold of us 24/7. We have somebody who is awake, on the job, at work, ready to take those crisis line calls 24/7, you know, all year long. Even on holidays, we are there answering the phone calls. So I think they're community is pretty used to being able to contact us by phone, and we have crisis line calls that happen all the time, so they're sort of used to that, to being just on the phone with folks as well and talking about what's happened in their lives. I think that it's the other areas that are going to be hard.
One thing that comes to mind for both you and Jenny's agency is survival of this incredibly important service, given what's going on economically and the fact that we're all shut down, which includes fundraising efforts. How are you and your colleagues planning to weather this storm?
Well, the areas that are suffering for us are, we have three retail stores, thrift stores, that we shut down almost immediately and are not taking any donations of people's goods. So a little bit worried about that. Fortunately, we did not have any big fundraising events on the calendar. So we're not having to worry about that. And I think the other really good news for everyone in our field is our government funding sources have been very willing to adapt to these new service standards, because we have an array of services we have to provide according to state statute, and they are giving us wiggle room on that. I mean, doing everything over the phone is absolutely not in compliance with our state statutes, and Cal OES, who is our primary funder for those things, has been very gracious in saying, hey, whatever you guys have to do, just make sure we know what you're doing. And they're allowing us to have staff work remotely. And so at least we don't have that fear of not being able to pay our direct service staff, which I think has been a great relief, because there are plenty of other things to worry about. And we've got, you know, partners who are losing their jobs and that kind of thing. But, we try not to do crisis-based fundraising. So we feel like we're a really strong organization, and we're doing important work here during this crisis, and we trust that the community will continue to support that.
Jenny, who should people call if they need help and they're not in either Sacramento County or Placer County?
There are some national organizations. NNEDV has a 1-800 number that people can call and find out who the domestic violence agency is in their community.
Who is that again?
And then, do you know their, I don't know their phone number.
I don't. There's also there's the National Domestic Violence Hotline. I mean, if you Google National Hotline, and I've actually visited them and watched how they work, they'll put your zip code in, they'll tell you all the resources in your community, and they'll provide support in the moment as well. I think that's probably the best bet is to call the National Hotline. Or they can call either of our agencies, and we can make those referrals. We get calls from all over the world, and so either option there.
Yeah.
That's great. And what is it that we all can do to help and to pitch in right now? Because going back to your example,
Jenny, about 1 in 4 on a block, mm-hmm. This is happening all around us. How can we get involved and do our part during this very difficult
time? I would encourage people to get educated. Go on our website, go on Stand Up Placer's website, and educate yourself about the types of abuse, the signs of domestic violence, how to recognize it, how to refer, and how to respond appropriately to people. That's one of the number one things I tell folks. If somebody discloses to you that something's going on in their relationship, respond with empathy. Tell them it's not their fault and that there's help for them, and know how to point them in the right direction. Now is a great time to be exploring websites and educating yourself about what you might do in case somebody does disclose to you.
Absolutely. And make sure, like we said earlier, isolation is one of the biggest sort of contributing factors right now. So make sure and stay in contact with people who you could, you know, like give your friends a call, check in with your neighbors, check in with your family members. And if something seems a little bit, sketchy, if somebody takes the phone out of their hand while they're trying to talk to you, if you see things that sort of raise the hair on the back of your neck, generally that's a pretty good barometer. And look into it and find out if they might need help. Get the crisis line numbers that you can give to them of who to call, or even calling law enforcement and asking for. A welfare check if there's something that's really scary where you think something could be going on. Don't ignore it. If you hear neighbors screaming and something sounds dangerous, report that. Just don't look the other way.
Actually, that's helpful. Could you also speak to, if I'm the victim of abuse, give us the first 3 to 5 steps we need to take in order to protect ourselves and maybe even a child? Who do we call first?
If you're in imminent danger, call 911. If you are just worried about your relationship, which is often how it starts, somebody isn't sure it counts as domestic violence. So we get a lot of calls of, hey, does this count? And we can walk people through a danger assessment where they actually get a score for how much danger we feel they're in. And so that's something anybody could do, even if you're not prepared to leave quite yet. We always tell people to document the abuse, keep a little journal somewhere, If you have any physical injuries, take pictures of them. It's a lot easier to get a restraining order down the road if you've got documentation of that. And gather any documents you might need if you do leave. It's really important that people have birth certificates, passports, any records, immunization records, whatever you might need for your kids, because it's really dangerous to have to go back to the house and get them. So those are the kinds of things we would tell people, frankly, in any time, COVID or not.
And I would say, like, calling either one of our crisis lines, because that could be confusing right now if somebody's watching right now and they're like, that's a lot, and I might forget one of those things. Both of us, we have people ready to answer that phone 24 hours a day who can help walk people through what do you need, what who should you call, what should you do. So call and find out, get information, and if it comes down to it and you can't find your birth certificate, just get out. You know, we'll help you apply for a new one. But do what you need to do to be safe right now and check in on your loved ones and your neighbors. And even if it's from across the fence, just, hey, how's it going? And try and stay in each other's lives as much as you can.
Great advice. Thank you both so much. And that's our show. Thanks to our guests and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syfax. See you next time right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.